Blog Talk Radio.
Care Act until 2015.
In the health reform debate, we fought to ensure that employers have a responsibility to provide affordable, comprehensive health benefits to their workers and their families. The employer responsibility provision included in the Affordable Care Act, while not as strong as we asked for, was designed to give large employers an incentive to offer or continue offering affordable, comprehensive health care coverage to some of their employees. The administration announcement that it is delaying employer responsibility assessments until 2015 is troubling because it removes that incentive for next year. In light of this decision, we believe it is even more urgent for Congress and the administration to reaffirm their commitment to employer responsibility. We appreciate the need for flexibility and common sense implementation of a new law, particularly one of this scope. There are a number of areas in which we have asked the ACA be interpreted to strengthen the delivery of benefits through employer-based plans. We hope the administration will address these concerns just as they have the concerns voiced by employers.
So, you know, they stretch this thing out to 2015. Oh, jeez. Sorry. You get something. No. Okay. Well, my fault. Well, cancer in a can. Shocking true story of how Pringles are made. To understand the nature of Pringles and other snackable chips, forget the notion. Oh, here we go. I'm getting blocked out here. Hang on a second. We try to do a little health stuff every night if we can, but... forget the notion that they come from actual potatoes in any recognizable way. Everybody's had Pringles, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
The Pringles Company, in an effort to avoid tax levied against luxury foods like chips in the UK, once even argued that the potato content of their chips was so low that they are technically not even potato chips. So if they're not made of potatoes, what are they exactly? That's a good question.
Scary.
I always thought they always said potatoes in there. Kind of tasted like potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know either. But anyway, we are realpharmacy.com is the company we're going to read from here as soon as it comes up. Realpharmacy.com. Anyway.
So? The process begins with a slurry of rice, wheat, corn, and potato flakes that are pressed into shape. The dough-like substance is then rolled out into an ultra-thin sheet, cut into chip cookies by a machine.
Whoops. Oh, that's great. Okay, here we go. All right. And the chips move forward on a conveyor belt until they're pressed into molds, which give them the curve that makes them fit into one another. Okay.
Those molds move through boiling oil, then they're blown dry, sprayed with powdered flavors, and at last flipped on a slow-moving conveyor belt in a way that allows them to stack. From then on, it's into the cans and off towards the innocent mouths of the consumers. I suspect nearly everyone reading this likely enjoys the taste of potato chips. However, they are clearly one of the most toxic processed foods you can eat, whether they're made from actual potato shavings or not. Potato chips are loaded with cancer-causing chemicals.
Oh, gosh.
One of the most hazardous ingredients in potato chips is not intentionally added, but rather is a byproduct of the processing. Acrylamide, a cancer-causing and potentially neurotoxic chemical, is created when carbohydrate-rich foods are cooked at high temperatures, whether baked, fried, roasted, or toasted. Some of the worst offenders include potato chips and French fries, but many foods cooked or processed at temperatures above 212 degrees Fahrenheit may contain acrylamide, As a general rule, the chemical is formed when food is heated enough to produce a fairly dry and brown-yellow surface. Hence, it can be found in potato chips, French fries, and other roasted or fried potato foods. Grains, bread crust, toast, crisp bread, roasted breakfast cereals, and various processed snacks. Coffee, roasted coffee beans, and ground coffee powder. Surprisingly, coffee substitutes based on chicory actually carry 2 to 3 times more acrylamide than real coffee. How much acrylamide are you consuming?
The federal limit of acrylamide is drinking water is 0.5 parts per billion, or about 0.12 micrograms in an 8-ounce glass of water. However, a 6-ounce serving of French fries can contain 60 of acrylamide, or about 500 times over the allowable limit. Similarly, potato chips are notoriously high in this dangerous chemical. So high, in fact, that in 2005, the state of California actually sued potato chip makers for failing to warn California consumers about the health risk of acrylamide in their products. A statement or a settlement was reached in 2008 when Frito-Lay and several other potato chip makers agreed to reduce the acrylamide levels in their chips to 275 parts per billion by 2011, which is low enough to avoid needing a cancer warning label. The 2005 report, How Potato Chips Stack Up, Levels of Cancer-Causing Acrylamide in Popular Brands of Potato Chips, issued by California-based Environmental Law Foundation, spelled out the dangers of this popular snack. Their analysis found that all potato chips products tested exceeded the legal limit of acrylamide by a minimum of 39 times and as much as 910 times. Some of the worst offenders in that time included Cape Cod Russet, Robust Russet, 910 times the legal limit, Kettle Chips, lightly salted, 505 times, Kettle Chips, Honey Dijon, 495 times. Holy cow. Beware, baked chips may be worse than fried. If you think you can avoid the health risks of potato chips by choosing baked varieties, which are typically advertised as being healthier, think again. Remember that acrylamide is formed not only when foods are fried or broiled, but also when they are baked.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and according to U.S. Foods and Drug Administration, data on acrylamide levels in food, baked chips, may contain more than 3 times the level of acrylamide as regular chips. Holy crap. So forget the baked stuff, all right, guys? Interestingly, the same trend holds true for other foods, too, which suggests that baking processed potatoes at high temperatures may be one of the worst ways to cook them. For instance, according to FDA data, Ore-Ida Golden Fries contain 107 parts per billion of acrylamide in the regular fried version and 1,098 when baked. Holy crap. So remember, all potato chips contain acrylamide, regardless of whether they are natural or not, baked or fried. Likewise, they will all influence your insulin levels in a very negative way. Oh, my God. Acrylamide is not the only danger. Acrylamide is not the only dangerous geotoxic compound formed when food is heated to high degrees. A 3-year-long EU project known as heat-generated food toxins, or HETOX, whose findings were published in the end of 2007, found there were more than 800 heat-induced compounds, of which 52 are potential carcinogens. In addition to their findings that acrylamide does pose a public health threat, the HETOX scientists also discovered that you are far less likely to ingest dangerous levels of toxins when you eat home-cooked foods compared to industrial or restaurant-prepared foods. Additionally, the HETOX findings also suggest that although there are ways to decrease exposure to acrylamide, it cannot be eliminated completely. And according to their calculations, successful application of all presently known methods would reduce the acrylamide intake by 40% at the most, which makes me wonder whether chip manufacturers have really succeeded at this point in reducing acrylamide levels to within legal limits. There's no updated data as to yet, so there's no telling whether they've been able to comply with the 2005 settlement. It's all part of the genocide, folks. You know, it's all part of genocide. So more in-depth information about acrylamide, I recommend reading the online report, Heat-Generated Food Toxins Identification Characteristics, Characterization of Risk Minimization.
So we're supposed to eat our food raw?
Yeah. In general, however, just remember that cooking food at high temperatures is ill-advised. Wow. A few of the most well-known toxins created in high-temperature cooking foods include heterocyclic amines. These form when meat is cooked at high temperatures, and they're also linked to cancer. Jesus. I mean, everything we eat is linked to cancer. In terms of HCA, the worst part of meat is the blackened sections, which is why you should always avoid charring your meat. Yeah. Never eat blackened sections. Wow, God. Pyrocyclic aerohydrocarbons.
Polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. When fat drips onto the heat source, causing excess smoke, and the smoke surrounds your food, it can transfer cancer-causing PAHSs to the meat. Advanced glycation end products. When food is cooked at high temperature, including when it is pasteurized or sterilized, it increases the formation of AGEs in your food. When you eat the food, it transfers AGEs to your body. Excuse me. The AGEs build up in your body over time, leading to oxidative stress, inflammation, and increased risk of heart disease, diabetes, and kidney disease.
God. The search of healthful chip continues.
Like a modern-day search for the Holy Grail, chip manufacturers keep searching for methods to improve the image of their health-harming but profitable snacks. For example, by the end of 2011, about half of Pepsi's Frito-Lay brand snacks will be reformulated with all natural ingredients. The switch is part of Pepsi Company's master plan to tap into the healthy food market share. The Wall Street Journal recently reported the company hopes to boost their nutrition business from $10 billion to $30 billion by 2020.
The company will remove dietary hazards like monosodium glutamate, replacing it with natural seasonings such as molasses and paprika. Artificial color will be replaced with beet juice, purple cabbage, and carrots. All in all, about different 60 snacks are scheduled to get an all-natural makeover. Right. This is certainly a good example of how consumer demand can alter the direction of food manufacturers in a positive way.
The reformulated chips may end up being less bad for you than the original formulations. However, chips will never be truly healthful. All natural chips may be the lesser of two evils, but if consumed regularly, they will still push your health in the wrong direction. There's no getting away from the fact that modern plagues such as cancer, heart disease, obesity, diabetes have a dietary component, and potato chips and French fries will always be a losing bet if you want to avoid becoming another disease statistic. How to avoid heat-induced toxins in your diet. Ideally, you should consume foods that are raw or minimally processed to avoid these types of toxic byproducts. The more raw food, the better. My nutrition plan emphasizes the need for at least one-third of your foods to be consumed raw. Personally, I consume about 80% of my food raw and find it is one of the most important factors that helps me keep healthy. It may take you a while to switch over to less processed diet, but throwing out the most obvious culprits would be a great start. These would include French fries and potato chips, all sodas, regular diet as artificial sweeteners may be more problematic than fructose and donuts.
Healthy eating made easy. Aside from creating potentially toxic byproducts, cooking and processing also depletes the food of valuable micronutrients, which is another reason for eating as much raw food as possible. This includes protein sources such as eggs. I'm not going to eat raw eggs, I'm sorry. raw whole eggs from I can't do that. Pasteurized chicken has an incredible source of high-quality nutrients that may be deficient in. Raw milk is another good example of food that is beneficial in a raw state but becomes harmful after it's pasteurized. By opting for food that will benefit your health, such as raw, preferably organic and locally grown vegetables, organic grass-fed meats, healthy oils, raw dairy nuts and seeds, you can change your health from the better. These are the foods that are truly natural and quite easy to prepare once you get the hang of it. Have you ever had a raw egg?
No, I don't think I've
It's the most
like
disgusting thing. I mean, a cooked egg is good,
mm-hmm.
but a raw egg will make you puke. I mean, it's really disgusting. For a step-by-step guide to make transitions to a healthier diet as simple and smooth as possible, simply follow the advice and optimize this. Remember, eating fresh whole foods is the secret to getting healthier, losing weight, and really enjoying your food. It's unfortunate that so many are under the mistaken belief that next to impossible to create a meal without processed foods. Bruce Weinstein, Mark Starbuck tackle the issue head on in their book Real Food Has Curves, which is a great starting point to relearn how to eat. And once you get used to it, you'll find you can whip up a healthful meal from scratch in the same amount of time that you've taken to drive down the street to pick up a fast food. And the main difference will be greater satisfaction, physical and mentally, and perhaps even financially, as processed food typically ends up being more expensive than cooking from scratch. There you go, folks. So I don't agree with this thing because totally. I mean, it's a good thing, but man, it's hard just to eat raw veggies, raw food, you know. And as far as meat is concerned, I mean, if you really eat meat, I think I like it cooked over raw, don't you?
Well, steak tartare is quite a delicacy.
Not for me. I don't like it very much at all. But do you like steak tartare? Have you had it?
No.
No, I haven't had it.
But it's quite a delicacy, apparently. Nasty
stuff. But, anyway.
Do we have any audios to share with
you? Well, we do, but I was going to go to some more of this union stuff that I wanted to cover. Interesting to bring up potato chips.
Mm.
And all the nastiness that goes with all this horrible stuff. Oh my God, huh? And it's really frightens me. You know, that you can't eat anything that doesn't cause cancer. And if you bring up the idea of conspiracy, right? Genocide. No, it's real, folks. It's real. It's real. So, hang on a second. We're trying to get right to the AFL-CIO blog again, but
mm-hmm.
It takes a few seconds to do that. Oh, boy. So, it was a real muggy, humid day today in Connecticut. I don't know where you were, if you're out in Arizona or some other place where it's horrendously hot. But it's at least you guys get dry heat out there. I don't know. We got humid heat. That stuff will kill you. July 10th, discussion. Will the NLRB be able to protect workers? Right. I don't know what the NLRB is.
National Labor Relations Board.
Okay, good. I hate these acronyms because you never know what the hell they are. Hang on, folks. I'm going to go to this article. Okay, the workplace rights of millions of working American people will be at risk if the U.S. Senate does not approve President Obama's 5-part bipartisan nominees to the National Labor Relations Board. On July 10th, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka will join Senator Jeff Merkley for a discussion on the NLRB.
National Labor Relations Board's role as an advocate for all U.S. workers. How the board can function in the face of Republican attempts to prevent it from doing its job and potential Senate rule changes to end the obstructionism that's blocking the National Labor Relations Board nominees. The discussion will take place at 9:30 a.m. EDT at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C.
There you go, folks. Check it out.
If you're in Washington, stop by.
If you're in Washington, stop by. So, there's all kinds of interesting news, but, you know, stuff that nobody can ever get to or nobody can ever go to. It's a bit bizarre. But, you know, hey, guys, we're hanging in there. We're trying to bring you this stuff, this news. Trying to find something that's worth talking about here.
Sequestration, nice cuts, long-term unemployment benefits.
Okay, let's check this one out.
It's terrible when you're out of work and then you're not going to get any benefits.
Yeah, and then they cut your unemployment benefits.
It's tough enough being out of work and forced to rely on none-too-generous unemployment insurance benefits. But now, thanks to sequestration, long-term jobless workers are seeing a reduction in their lifetime benefits.
Lifeline
benefits, excuse me. According to a new report from the National Employment Labor Project, federal emergency unemployment compensation benefits, which help workers after they exhaust state-level programs, most provide around 26 weeks of benefits, are being cut by 15% or about $43 from the average $289 weekly EUC benefit. Working families are calling on Congress to repeal the job-killing sequester.
Nearly 40% of people without jobs, about 4.4 million, have been out of work for 27 weeks or more. Some 8% of this year's sequestration cuts are aimed at the modest benefits provided to these workers, the report says. The cuts to each check becomes more severe the longer a state waits to implement them. And Maryland and New Jersey are cutting benefits by more than 22%. And 7 states cut benefits in May and June, reducing checks by 16.8% to 22.2%. And other states have eliminated weeks rather than reduced benefits. Maine cut the last 8 weeks of benefits, and Florida eliminated the last 4. All right. California, the state with the most workers collecting unemployment compensation benefits, cut checks by 17.7% in May alone, for 120,000 workers. About 429,000 will experience cuts through September 30th and 531 by the end of the year if sequestration continues. Jobless workers in North Carolina lost their long-term benefits because of cuts that the Republican legislature passed in the February that went into effect July 1st. Those cuts, as lawmakers knew at the time, made the state ineligible for federal unemployment funds. Working families are called on their elected representatives to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid from benefit cuts, but repeal the sequester and make sure corporations, the wealthiest 2%, pay their fair share through closing loopholes. And, you know, that only makes sense, but I mean, it's god awful, you know, that these states would do that to their people, you know. They can't provide them jobs, they can't bring in any jobs, but by God, they can sure cut their benefits.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That seems to happen regularly, doesn't it?
Yeah, like our state, you know, losing jobs, losing people, stupid bastards. United Auto Workers, evolving to recreate the middle class.
Well, that's a positive thing.
Well, maybe. So let's see how.
Check out UAW President Bob King's new editorial in the Detroit News on the future of worker-employee relationship. King says it's time for foreign automakers to grant workers at their American factories the same rights to form unions and collectively bargain that workers have in the automakers' home countries. An excerpt from the editorial, it says, globalization has radically altered the competitive environment facing the auto sector. Indeed, we have paid the price for fought failing to learn these lessons quickly enough. But as the global economy changes, manufacturers' union strategies are changing too. Our goal for our members are the same. Dignity, fairness, respect, and a strong middle class standard of living. The UAW strategies to achieve these goals have adapted to meet 21st century global changes. With smart employers who know the value of a collaboration with workers in their unions, the us versus them mentality is replaced with values of flexibility, innovation, teamwork, and cooperation. Union members are pro-company and pro-union. The only true path to job security is producing the safest, best quality, highest value product. Labor and management must work together to keep automakers competitive in the global market. By emphasizing mutual respect, common goals, and creative problem-solving with the company, UAW members bring their best to the shop floor. They are committed to delivering the best product at the best value to consumers. And that's good for all of us.
Yeah. There's one article, but we'll move along here.
And that was by Kenneth Quinnell off the AFL-CIO Now blog.
Yeah. And we're trying to move along here, but it's taking a little while. As we do,
we can go to a little music break.
There we go.
Oh, finally came up. I think we've read a lot of these.
This just came out today. Reflecting on comprehensive immigration. Are we done? I have a lot of questions about this. And,
Made in America pet treats and products. This week, Americans will celebrate the July 4th and America's independence. It'll also be time when public ceremonies are held to swear in newly naturalized American citizens. That gives us a chance to reflect on the comprehensive immigration reform and think about the economic implications. First, it's important to look back at U.S. immigration law. In the beginning, the United States did not have limits on immigration. The earliest law passed in 1790 was a naturalization law declaring that only free whites of good moral character could be naturalized and that a person born in the United States was a citizen only if his or her father was a U.S. citizen. So any free white person could apply to be naturalized after 2 years. There was no quota placed on the number of immigrants. This is important since many people want to claim their ancestors arrived here legally, implying some legal limit existed before that, but they obeyed. In 1787, the U.S. Constitution protected the transatlantic slave trade by saying Congress could not pass laws to limit the importation of slaves from Africa until after 1807. Then in 1807, Congress passed and President Thomas Jefferson signed into law the the end of bringing slaves from Africa into the United States, effective January 1, 1808. So those African Americans who are the descendants of American slavery traced their roots in America to before 1808. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution, ratified in July 1868, stated that all persons born in the U.S. were citizens, clarifying the right to citizenship of African Americans born into slavery. Congress subsequently passed the Naturalization Act of 1870, further clarifying the right of persons of African descent to become naturalized citizens of the U.S.
And while the 1870 Act clarified the status of African Americans, it left in place the uncertainty around how other persons of color, any other persons of color. Congress addressed this in the negative with the Page Act of 1875, which restricted Chinese men coming to the United States to work, granted forced labor, and for Chinese women to come to the United States, a set of exclusions that Congress would reinforce in 1882 and again in 1892, increasing restrictions on Chinese immigration. This was expanded with the Immigration Act of 1917, that barred immigration from Asia and the Asian subcontinent. These were not reversed until the 1940s, when Congress lifted the bans and clarified the rights of people of Asian descent to be naturalized citizens of the United States. Wow. They had to go, they went through a lot of, they went through a long period of discrimination. Not until the 1920s did Congress pass laws limiting immigration from other countries, imposing emergency quotas in 1921, and later cementing the place national quotas in 1924. So for the bulk of Americans of European descent, all immigration was legal and that no limits were placed until 1921, and aimed primarily at limiting immigration from South European countries like Italy. So the major waves of European immigration that took place in the 1850s, 1880s, and 1910s faced no legislative limits. That's interesting. Once national quotas were in place, the sense that an immigrant was illegal meant they were from a country that exceeded the country's quota. Before 1921, it meant you were a race that America did not like, but the national quota laws meant replicating the national origin of people already in the United States, a great advantage to Europeans while a big disadvantage to people of color. Not until the Civil Rights Movement forced America to re-examine the issue of race did immigration laws change to remove this heavy bias in 1965. Ironically, by giving each nation the same quota, it meant that some countries could face more binding quotas, and for the first time, Mexican immigrants could face a quota. And since Mexico has a common border with the United States, this obviously means the quota is more binding on Mexican immigration than on other countries. Wow. Well, just a couple more things. Want to read some of this?
Go ahead.
The 1990s, there's a long history to put the discussion of comprehensive immigration into a bigger context. Each wave of immigration faced a reaction, whether Know-Nothing Party members of the 1850s who disliked Catholic immigrants from Ireland, or later xenophobic reactions to Italians that brought on a sense of panic. And each wave was felt to hurt the labor market of native-born Americans. The 1990s saw a record massive wave of immigration, but also saw one of the largest growths of jobs in U.S. economic history. The black unemployment rate that wallowed in double digits from September 1974 to June 1997 finally returned to single-digit levels and reached a record low of 7.3% in November 2000. In 1995, for the first time, households in the middle quintile of income in the black community overlapped with the middle class and the white distribution, making some blacks truly middle income. And in 2000, the share of black families with children living in poverty fell to a record low. Clearly, massive immigration did not stop that good news.
I think that's fascinating, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that.
So claims about legal versus illegal immigration, in the sense that immigration must hurt the fate of American workers, is very complex. What is clear about the 1990s experience is that macroeconomic policies matter. Putting in place policies that aim for full employment trump the immigration flow effect on increasing the labor supply to depress wages. Federal Reserve to let the unemployment rate fall below 4.5% in the late 1990s, the lowest rate since the late 60s, before it tried to slow the economy was important. Infiltration and stagflation during the 1970s had convinced economic policymakers that unemployment rates at that level would cause inflationary pressures that could not be easily stopped. It's interesting. There's only a couple more paragraphs here, so let me read it. But the harm done to low-wage workers and millions of workers in the shadows can be corrected. Indeed, it is addressed by the Senate legislation. Not just workers, but employers were hiding work and jobs from enforcement of labor law and from job seekers who needed information on job openings. Helping to correct an imbalance in labor laws and worker rights while help to correct an imbalance in the ability of workers to bargain freely about their wages and working conditions and to form unions, and it will increase the reach of labor law enforcement. All workers will benefit from this sunshine. But ultimately, the real issue is a set of policies that aims for full employment and puts the priority on getting people paid, getting more people paid. That must be the first priority of policies. The immigration law passed by the Senate could, over a decade, usher in a new wave of almost 10 million more workers through business-friendly changes and open a new flow of science and engineering workers, college professors, multinational executives, physicians, and their families, who will be permanent residents, which is about the size of the 1990s wave of immigration. That new wave can boost America's economic growth to new heights and so lower our federal deficit, as the Congressional Budget Office predicts, or without full employment policies being the first priority, could cause the labor market to continue to make wage sags and pile up unemployed Americans. So it's up to Congress and the President to get to work now, putting full employment first. I agree with that, but you know, I don't see how allowing 8 more million or 10 more million workers in here is going to increase the work outflow. All it's going to do is take 8 more million jobs away from people that are already here. So, I don't know, folks. I got issues with this immigration policy, and I don't know. The unions don't make much sense about this as far as I'm concerned, but hey, you know, they make a lot of sense about other things. Right, Lella?
Well, I think so.
And I can't see the benefit of this immigration bill. I don't see it. No. That's just me. Oh, my. I think it's time for a music break.
I think so.
I think we deserve a music break. Some kind of a music break.
I was trying to find an audio.
I got a little music break. We'll come back to something interesting. Thank you.
I think I read that.
Sure.
This is an interesting article, folks. McDonald refuses to open a branch in the West Bank illegal settlement. The U.S.-based food giant McDonald has turned down an offer to open a branch in an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank, and yet another backlash to the regime's illegal settlement activity. On Thursday, Irina Shalmor, spokeswoman for McDonald's Israel, said the chain had declined a demand by the owners of a mall under construction in the Ariel settlement to start a restaurant there, according to its policy of staying out of the occupied Palestinian territories. Omri Patton, owner of McDonald's Israel, is the founder of the Israeli watchdog Peace Now, which has voiced opposition to all illegal settlement activities. The group considers the Tel Aviv regime settlement construction as an obstacle to peace. The decision by the multinational food franchise has irked Israeli officials and settlers. Yegel Del Monte, an Israeli settlement activist, said McDonald's has gone from being a for-profit company to an organization with an anti-Israel political agenda. Many countries, including some of Tel Aviv's allies, have condemned the Israeli plans to construct illegal settler units in the occupied Palestinian territories. More than 500,000 Israelis live in over 120 illegal settlements. On Wednesday, the Israeli regime approved the construction of 69 new illegal settlement units in East Al-Quds, despite widespread international criticism. On June 13th, an Israeli regime spokesperson said that Tel Aviv would build more than 1,000 new illegal units in the West Bank settlements, namely Itamar and Buchen. Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, criticized the settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank on June 15th, calling the move a violation of international law.
Just for the hell of it, knocking on the gates of Jerusalem, demonstration against injustice of Israeli occupation. On Saturday, June 29th, a group of Palestinian activists demanded access to the occupied city of Jerusalem through the gate in the apartheid wall in Bethlehem. And there to this article, I hope. We haven't talked much about this. There hasn't been as much news recently about Palestine. But on the 29th, their nonviolent demonstration also aimed to highlight Palestinian opposition to the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's visit, but was met with violence from the Israeli occupation military. The apartheid wall gate was closed in the face of protesters shutting them out of their illegally occupied land. At around 11 a.m., Palestinian activists, accompanied by international demonstrators, walked toward the checkpoint of the apartheid wall toward Jerusalem. Access is granted by the Israeli occupation authorities for very few Palestinians. People agreed the age of 18 to 45 are routinely denied permits. The Palestinian demonstrators had demanded right of entry to their capital city, Jerusalem. Israeli occupation military immediately reacted violently at the checkpoint and pushing and shoving nonviolent protesters. One demonstrator was pushed aggressively to the ground by a heavy armed Israeli soldier. About 20 soldiers were involved in suppressing the peaceful demonstration. And after about 10 minutes of harassment at the Palestinian protesters, they closed the apartheid wall gate. This is the second attempt in 2 weeks of Palestinians to cross into occupied Jerusalem. They vowed to continue to demand an end to the restriction of movement imposed by the Palestinian people by the Israeli occupation. Protesters held signs saying, "Kerry, go home," and slogans about apartheid. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was permitted to enter occupied Jerusalem 2 days ago, on Thursday, June 27th, where he met Israeli occupation Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. His meeting with the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas was forced to take place in Amman, Jordan, rather than occupy Jerusalem. Kerry is advocating peace talks, but has not taken strong action against the Israeli obstacles to peace, which include denying the right of return to the Palestinian refugees
mm-hmm.
and increasing illegal settlements in the West Bank and Jerusalem. As Kerry arrived into the Middle East, Netanyahu approved yet another settlement expansion in East Jerusalem. Further, the U.S. continues to fund the Israeli occupation government and military operations to the tune of $3 billion a year. Palestinians will continue to knock the gates of Jerusalem to highlight the injustice of the Israeli occupation. And, you know, Kerry, you got to understand, Kerry is not an Irishman. Kerry's a Jew. His actual name is Kern. He changed his name from Kern to Kerry in order to run for politics in Boston, okay, because no one would elect a Jew in Boston, you know. So, you know, Kerry's a fraud, always has been a fraud, and still is a fraud, all right? And, you know, so I don't understand why the unions in this country don't protest the Palestinian occupation. You know what I mean? And, you know, I don't know. But, you know, they protest everything else, but they don't protest that kind of mess. Anyway, we got a few minutes. Israel secret uranium buy, and, you know,
all kinds of things going on there. Yeah.
Let's see if there's anything exciting here.
The longer the shelf life, the shorter yours. That's probably
true. Yeah,
People make up great things.
Let's see. It says, internet firms to protest the NSA programs. What they call a day late and a dollar short.
Yeah.
A number of American internet companies are preparing to protest against U.S. surveillance programs leaked last month by former National Security Agency contractor. The online protest is set to be launched on Nation's Independence Day.
Sure. American whistleblower Edward Snowden revealed last month that the NASA, the U.S. super spy agency, is massively collecting telephone call and internet records of people around the world, including American citizens. U.S. companies including Reddit, Mozilla, 4chan, and WordPress are now saying they will display anti-NASA spying messages on their home pages on Thursday. And
WordPress, you know, is important because I have a WordPress website, you know. So it's like,
that's good.
Yeah, thankfully.
Whether that'll make any difference, even though they're opposed to it.
I don't know what difference it makes because anybody can read my website. A number of, U.S. companies, including supporters of the protest, can refer to
CaliforFreedom.org to donate money to help fund TV ads against the U.S. intelligence programs and press for action from American lawmakers, according to the report. The protest has been organized by Internet Defense League, which estimates thousands of sites will participate. The NSA program that has been exposed are blatantly unconstitutional and have a detrimental effect on free speech and freedom of the press worldwide, said Tiffany Chang, a spokeswoman for the Internet Defense League. On Tuesday, a bipartisan group of 25 American senators forwarded a letter to the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, asking him to publicly supply more details about the NSA spying program. They asked Mr. Clapper to reveal the extent and duration of the programs. I want to know if they're being spied on. The lawmakers said that depends on a secret law to conduct domestic spying activities raises serious civil liberty concerns. The leaker of the information has been stranded in a transit area of Moscow airport for more than a week. He is now asking asylum from 21 countries after Russia and Ecuador reportedly denied this asylum request. Snowden is facing charges of espionage and theft of government property in the United States. That's not fair. He's just a whistleblower.
I'm very surprised that Ecuador, you know, gave up their. They were so adamant about taking them. It just shows you what weenies these countries all are when it comes to facing the United States. Weenies.
Yep, I think.
Ecuador is a weenie. So there are all these other asshole countries. God, you know, come on. Can any of these guys stand up to the United States? Come on. No, weenies. Weenies from hell. All right, let's start with Maria.
Let's just read some headlines because we only have a couple of minutes. Greece given 3 days to show aid worthiness, officials say.
Let's see. What was the other one there? Bomb explosions hit Baghdad markets, killing 35 and injuring dozens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. NASA discovers carbon dioxide as a coolant. Destroys globalist warming myth.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah,
Al Gore, what a...
This is an interesting article. It's extremely long.
I read part of it.
Yeah, it's really long. But, you know, it shows you that carbon dioxide is the global coolant. It's not what's causing the Earth warming. Earth warming is a fraud. And Dutch just injustice with child trafficking rules nation. Okay. Let's go on here. Come on. Well, we're pleased to know that they kicked out the Egyptian forces have kicked out the new leader, okay, of Egypt.
Uh-huh.
We're happy to know that, since the guy turned out to be a crap head. Okay. And
we'll see what happens now.
I thought this was interesting. This is a 6 minutes gonna go over. Obama administration is planning to force Americans to move into cities, which is part of Agenda 21. U.S. General Cartwright has been indicted for espionage.
Mm.
That was very strange. And let's see.
Apple dodges all taxes in the
UK. Yeah, that was pretty wild.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, let's look at this. It's 6 minutes long. It's going to run over time, but it's worth listening to. And this is Fox News, but Obama administration plans to force Americans to move into cities. This is all part of the Agenda 21 program. Let's listen to a couple minutes of this. All right, love?
Yep.
Bags. Years ago, moving to the suburbs was a sign that you were making a better life for yourself and your family. But our next guest details a government report suggesting there may be a long-term plan to change all that for you. The effort to, quote, Manhattanize America. Next. Well, if you live in the suburbs, don't get too comfy. Our next guest says the Obama administration has plans to push Americans, slowly but surely, out of the burbs and into the big cities, as a means to, quote, spread the wealth around. Joining us now is Stanley Kurtz. He's author of Spreading the Wealth, How Obama is Robbing the Suburbs to Pay for the City. And this isn't based on your book, this claim. This is based on something you actually saw President Obama and the administration do last week. Explain, Stan.
Well, that's right, Megan. It looks like President Obama's plans to fight global warming are going to hurt America's suburbs. And that's because the Obama administration believes in something called smart growth. Now, the idea of smart growth policies is that you should get out of your car, don't move to the suburbs, you should live in a tiny, densely packed apartment building in the city where you would walk and take public transportation, don't drive. And that smart growth, and the Obama administration is gearing up to impose these smart growth policies on the country, and that would be bad for America's suburbs.
How would they do it? How would they make us move from the suburbs to the city? Because most of the folks who live in the suburbs like the suburbs. They don't want to live in the city. How would they make us do it?
Well, there are several plans, Megan, and part of the idea is just to stop people from moving out to the suburbs in the first place. But in the end, it might even get some people who are living in suburbs to head to the cities. Last week, the Energy Department released a series of reports that touted a new strategy for cutting back on carbon dioxide emissions. The idea is to make all federal funding conditional on adherence to these smart growth principles. So let's say the federal government is thinking of funding a new school or a new highway. Well, if this idea goes through, the government would say, well, let's look at the population density. If you've got a high population density, we'll give you the federal money. If you don't, you're not going to get the money. And that would start channeling new development away from the suburbs and into the cities. And if you think about it, it's actually a way of redistributing the wealth of the suburbs to the cities.
This is an actual proposal that was put forward?
Well, a report came out called Transportation Energy Futures, and one of these reports floated this proposal. At this stage, it's a trial balloon, I think you could say, but there's another similar proposal that, according to a news report, the Obama administration has already decided on, and that is that the Obama administration, for the first time, is going to tell every agency of the federal government to consider carbon dioxide emissions before they give environmental approval to big projects, and that could mean big delays, big challenges, maybe even the elimination of some, say, highway construction projects out into the suburbs. So if you want to have that traffic congestion relieved on your suburban commute, or maybe opening up a new area for suburban development with a highway, that could be delayed and possibly even blocked by these new regulations. And that, again, would tend to channel development away from the suburbs and back to the city.
Now, you talk in your piece, which was posted on National Review Online, about how, yes, of course, this focuses in part, this initiative that's been proposed focuses in part on greenhouse gas emissions and making the environment more green, and, you know, your carbon footprint when you live in a little 800-square-foot apartment in Manhattan is much, much smaller than if you live in, you know, a 3,000-square-foot home in the burbs. So that's clear. That could be one of the goals. But you also say that this is about wealth redistribution on a grand scale. How so? How is it a redistribution of wealth?
Well, that's what I talk about in the book, Megan. If you go back to Obama's whole political history, people don't realize it, but he's been a big backer of this, a movement called regionalism. The whole idea of regionalism is that there's something fundamentally unfair about the very existence of suburbs, because when people move out to suburbs, they take their tax money with them. And President Obama and some of the people he used to work with in his political career believed that that was somehow unfair to the cities. So if you put in these smart growth policies and you say it's all about carbon dioxide and global warming, you still are channeling all that federal money, which comes from all of our taxes, after all, into the cities and away from the suburbs. And that's a way of redistributing wealth from the suburbs to the cities. And in the minds of these advocates of regionalism that Obama has always worked with, this is a way of redistributing money back away from the suburbs and into the cities.
But you still have the same crop of people. So if you're forcing folks who live in the suburbs to eventually move back into the city, or people who live in the city not to move out to the suburbs, it's still the same people. You're not going to change their political worldview. You're not going to change their voting habits necessarily.
Well, some people think it might change voting habits. It's unclear whether that will really happen. But the point for these regionalists is that you're stopping tax money from being taken away from the cities and put into the suburbs. These regionalists think that there's something fundamentally unfair about that. So what they first want to do is get taxpayers back to the cities so that their money can go into the coffers of those city governments and not the suburban governments, and maybe the politics will take care of itself after that.
You call it an effort to Manhattanize America, and a lot of our viewers won't like the thought of that, since there's a reason they've chosen not to live in Manhattan, and it's not just the, you know, block jam traffic at rush hour and the taxi cabs and the pollution and all that. Sorry, Mayor Bloomberg, but you know what I'm talking about. And they don't necessarily want Iowa to look like Manhattan, but in any event, Stanley, very interesting hearing your perspective. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Megan.
That was an interesting
And we've come right to the end of our show.
We have to really concern ourselves for this, folks.
So we'll say good night.
Yeah.
And have a good night, folks. Stay tuned for Thursday.
Yeah.
For Leo to enter the esoteric realm. Until next week, good night.
Good night, everybody.